Welcome to Lady Killers, a podcast about female serial killers. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. Let's go dig up some bodies. And welcome back to the Lady Killers podcast. Just a second. We will be continuing with our study of Eileen Wuornos. Last week was part one. And if you are listening to this as it's coming out today, I am currently on my way to Phoenix, Arizona. I will be attending the Chandler International Film Festival in Arizona because my screenplay, Loon Lake, is one of the screenplays that was selected for a table read by the actors there. And it also means that Loon Lake is nominated for an award at the festival. And Sunday will be that table read. And then the following day, Monday night, that is when I will find out if any awards were won for Loon Lake. So pretty excited to be in Chandler for the film festival and can't wait to network with everybody that's here and just check it out, see what's happening, and see some great films that are out there. Keep the independent film, just the spirit of independent film alive. That's what I intend to do, and I can't wait to keep going forward with Loon Lake. I'm gonna keep you all up to date as the festival goes on. I'm gonna start searching around. While I'm in Arizona, I want to see if there's a lady killer from Arizona that I would like to do for next week. And so while I'm in Arizona, I'll be looking around, I'll be talking to people, see if anybody, any of the locals, anybody from Arizona knows of a good female serial killer that I could do the podcast on. And I am also, you know, wanting to look around the Phoenix area to see if there's going to be any guests I might be able to snag for the next episode of Lady Killers. So I'll keep my eyes open for that. I'll be looking around the festival, talking to people, and seeing if anybody has a little bit of time they can take away from their precious time at the festival to talk to me for a little bit. If time does not allow for that while I'm here, I'll record a new episode once I return back home, and then just release it the same week as I always do. And if any of you out there want to read my screenplay, Loon Lake, before it comes out as a film later this year, just head on over to Amazon and check it out. It's available as either an electronic download or as a paperback. And it is perfect for those of you who love horror and thrillers. It's just perfect for that. A little bit of slasher in there. So check it out. It's a good read for this cold weather in the winter here to bundle up by the fire and just read a real scary story. But enough all the housekeeping, we've got that out of the way. I think it's time to resume our look at the monster that terrorized Florida, Eileen Wuornos. When we last left this wild woman, she was raising hell with her girlfriend, the love of her life, Tyra Moore. And Eileen, she was still employed as a sex worker, and she was just cruising up and down I-75 in Florida, looking for anyone to pay for sex to help her and her girlfriend make ends meet. She had plenty of business along this busy freeway. There were a lot of lonely drivers out there just looking for someone like Eileen. Unfortunately, Eileen's hatred towards men was continually growing with each John that she picked up and satisfied. On November 30th, 1989, a 51-year-old electronic store owner pulled off the interstate when he spotted Eileen shaking her goods on the side of the road. His name was Richard Mallory. Now, Richard Mallory, he was a convicted rapist from Clearwater, Florida. And that was a fact which was not known to Eileen, obviously, at the time of their interaction, or else she would not have gotten into the car with him. But anyway, she hopped into his 1977 Cadillac, and the two sped off to find a quiet spot to get to know each other a little bit better. One can only speculate what happened in the vehicle before Eileen pulled her gun out and emptied it into his chest. Later on, when she was questioned by police, Eileen would claim that it was done only in self-defense because Mallory was raping her. Now, Mallory, he was known to pick up prostitutes and abuse them. And this, it just sickens me so much more knowing that information about this guy. And I think most women that find themselves as sex workers, they're not really doing it by choice. Some of them, yes, I believe they are, but you know, they feel like it's the only way out. It's the only way they can support themselves and support their families. And they're driven to this profession out of necessity. And I think Eileen Wuornos did the same. I'd heard her in some interviews saying the same thing. The reason she became a sex worker is to make ends meet. She had rent due, just like everybody else. And, you know, it needed to be paid. And this is the best way she could pay for it. You know, and it's already a horribly dangerous job. And you throw into the mix sex offenders on the prowl looking for fresh prey, and you have an intensely dangerous situation. Eileen was no exception to this. Yes, she was a violent and criminal being at the time of her interaction with Richard Mallory, you know, but this is no reason for him to try to have his way with her any way that he chooses and force her to do whatever it is he wants to do. Now, whether Eileen truly was acting out of self-defense will never be known, but it is likely that's what happened, and that's why she blasted him away with her revolver. Richard Mallory's Cadillac was found first outside Daytona a few days after he was murdered. And just a few days after that, on December 13th, his naked and bloodied body was found in a forested area along I-95 in Volusia County, several miles away from where his vehicle was actually found. His cause of death ended up being the two bullet holes in his left lung from a .22 caliber revolver. The results from the autopsy also showed there was a decent amount of alcohol in his system, which isn't really too surprising since we all know Eileen loved to drink, and you know, she was arrested on multiple times for either disturbing the peace while drunk, getting into bar fights, drunk driving, you name it. When it came to alcohol, she loved it. She loved her beer. But I don't want to sound like I'm on Eileen Wuornos' side here in this matter. But if Mallory really did try to rape her, as she insisted, or did rape her, as she insisted, maybe he did deserve a couple bullets right into the chest. You know, she was already working that dangerous job as a sex worker that, you know, left her extremely vulnerable to the creeps like Mallory, who was a convicted rapist, if you've forgotten already. He took advantage of a sex worker who was simply doing what she could to survive. But unfortunately, it was the monster from Florida that he encountered. And she wasn't some meek and mild-mannered girl that he might have been used to take advantage of. It was a heavy-duty monster. But in any event, Eileen had officially graduated as a criminal. She went from a petty thief, a check forger, to a cold-blooded murderer who would soon be known as the Florida Highway Killer. Eileen Wuornos would continue working up and down the highways and byways of Florida, hopping into trucks and cars of lonely men, mostly older white men. Eileen chose older men because they supposedly would be safer to be around. They're not as strong and virile as some of the younger men looking for some sex workers out on the road. So she would gravitate towards the older men. And as I look at the pictures of some of her victims, they all really resemble one another a lot, actually, if you take a look at those pictures. So she continued on in this fashion for a few more months until she happened upon a 43-year-old by the name of David Spears, a machine operator out of Sarasota, Florida. Again, nobody knows what transpired in the vehicle between the two, just whatever stories you hear from Eileen Wuornos. That's all we have is her testimony. And in her testimony, she said that Spears, again, she tried to rape her after they had already settled on a location and a price for their interaction. And Eileen, who was sick and tired of men trying to take advantage of her, just blasted him with 6 shots to his body with that same .22 caliber weapon used in the Mallory murder. On June 1st, 1990, David Spears' naked body was found along U.S. Route 19 in Citrus County. His body had 6 bullet holes all along his torso. And I guess David Spears had reportedly been missing since May 19th. So it is unclear when Eileen actually hopped in his vehicle and did the deed to end his life. But his truck was found days later along I-75. All of the doors were unlocked and the license plate was missing. David Spears, he was just another man looking for a good time. But he found his demise when he came across the Florida Highway Killer. He was another man that allegedly tried to rape a vulnerable sex worker, and he ended up being shot by the monster with a .22. Now let's flash forward to June 6, 1990, when the body of a 40-year-old rodeo worker was found. His name was Charles Carskadon. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was found wrapped in an electric blanket in Pasco County off of I-75, just like the other victims. And upon discovery of his body, the authorities could see that he was also shot with a .22 caliber weapon, just like the other two bodies that had been found. And he had been shot about 8 times, it had appeared. And when he was found, like I say, the body was naked and wrapped up just like the others had been found. And it was already badly decomposing, though, so it was tough to identify who that body was for a while. And the authorities, they asked around the area, desperately seeking out any witnesses they could find. And some claim they saw Eileen with Carskadon's vehicle. Some witnesses also claim that Warnos had pawned off a gun that had belonged to this latest victim. And after the autopsy was performed, it was concluded that he was killed on or around May 31st, which is possibly the same night or even, you know, the night before, but very close to her second victim, David Spears. But like I say, the body was so badly decomposed that they couldn't really pin an exact date on it, and it took them a while to even identify who the body was. So now here we are with Eileen. She had offed 3 Johns already. 3 Johns that had gotten rough with her. And in her mind, she had no choice but to defend herself with her .22 handgun. And it's the same handgun. That's the gun that led authorities to believe maybe they were dealing with a serial killer here. 3 murders of 3 older white men, all found naked and riddled with bullets from a .22 caliber weapon. Seems like it all matches up there, so they started to think there was a serial killer on their hands. All the bodies were found in different counties around that area, though, so the police, each county had to notify the other county and tell them to really keep up on the case because they think something's going on here. We got a serious situation on our hands. So, you know, they sent out bulletins to all the different counties around the area. And so they really put that at the top of their list, looking for a suspect. And then on June 7th of 1990, Peter Seams, a 65-year-old retired merchant seaman, left his home in Jupiter, Florida, and he also was leaving behind his Christian outreach ministry that he was devoting much of his time to. So he was a Christian man, but he wanted to go visit some family over in Arkansas. So he hopped into his 1988 Pontiac Sunbird, and he headed out towards Arkansas. But he would never arrive at his destination. On July 4th, 1990, his car, that 88 Pontiac Sunbird, was found in Orange Springs, Florida, which is about 250 miles away from the city he actually departed from. and the car was partially hidden off in some brush off the highway. There was a witness in this case that saw this car. Her name was Rhonda Bailey. She claimed she saw Eileen and her girlfriend abandon that victim's car after they had crashed it off of the highway. And apparently they piled out of the car. There was beer cans everywhere. They were chugging beers, throwing beer cans at each other, yelling at each other, just, you know, acting foolish, running through the forest. And they came up to Rhonda's house and they begged Rhonda not to call the police, you know, because they said they were so close to their home that was just up the road. Don't call the police. We can get home just fine. Don't worry about us. So they hopped back into the crashed car and they tried to drive it a little bit further and it just crapped out on them right up the road. And so some firefighters also showed up at this crash scene, tried to find out if they needed help, but they were told immediately to leave by Eileen, who started yelling at them and cursing at them. And eventually they left and nothing came of that. So they had the monster from Florida there right at their fingertips and they let her go. When the police finally arrived and found that vehicle, they said it was beat up pretty good. All of the windows were smashed out and the interior was covered in blood. They searched the vehicle and they found one palm print that was on the interior door handle. And this print would end up, later on, we will find out it ends up being Eileen's print. But at least the police did have something to go on. They also saw that the license plate was missing, which that was something that was common in all of Eileen's cases. Because it allowed her to just travel around in various stolen vehicles, switching plates from car to car and getting around that way. But now, with this fourth victim, the authorities ramped up their investigation. Now, Rhonda Bailey, that witness that had actually talked to the girls after that car accident, she got together with a sketch artist at the police department, and they put together two pretty good sketches of Eileen and Tyria, and they passed them around the area, and also they actually sent it out on the wire and got that going nationally. So they had the sketches of those two women going around nationally, and that fourth victim, they found his car, but they still had high hopes of finding the old man's body, because the witnesses, they gave great descriptions, and the pictures they were sending out, the sketch artist made, were pretty good depictions of the two women. So the hopes were high for the police department that they would either find the suspects or find somebody that might know where the body is of Peter Seams. Sadly, the body of poor old Peter Seams was never found. On July 31st, 1990, a 50-year-old sausage salesman by the name of Troy Burris was reported missing from his home in Ocala. He had left the previous day on one of his normal truck delivery routes, but he never returned home as he normally did after his route was over. His manager became very worried, and he called around to all the stops that he was supposed to be making along his route, and apparently he had never made it to the last few stops that were along his route. This sent his wife into a panic, so she reported him missing, and by 4 a.m. on the 31st of July, Burris' truck was found about 20 miles east of Ocala. The truck was unlocked, but the keys were missing, as well as the owner of the vehicle, Troy Burris. On August 4th, Troy Burris' body was found in a wooded area along State Road 19 in Marion County. A picnicking family who were on an outing in the Ocala National Forest came upon his body, and it was about 8 miles from where his truck was found. The body had been shot twice, once in the front and once in the back. By the time the body was found, because of all the humidity and the high heat that is in Florida, especially in the middle of summer, the body had decomposed rapidly and it immediately could not be identified. So they had to call his wife in, and Geez, the most horrible thing. His wife had to ID the body, but when she got there, you know, it was an awful thing to see. You know, she gets there and there's just a pile of pulp and organic matter that's supposed to be a body. And the only way that she recognized that it was her husband was from the wedding ring that was still on his finger. And she knew instantly it was him. And it's just awful. I mean, nobody should ever have to do that. Nobody should ever have to ID a body that way. You know, especially just a pile of kind of melted and oozing flesh and guts and whatever else. And she had to see what her husband looked like now just by the wedding ring. It's an awful thing to even think about. Having to gaze down on that and try to make out what's there, who used to be there. Awful. So authorities, they briefly had one suspect that they came across. His name was Curtis Blankenship, and he was a drifter that they had known from the area. He had been seen hitchhiking in the area where Burris's truck was found. So they ran him in for questioning, and I mean, soon enough, they figured out as the investigation continued and as questioning continued with Mr. Blankenship, authorities knew that he had nothing to do with any of the murders, and so he was cut loose and ready to go. So after 5 murders, investigators were still baffled, and they still claimed they had no suspects in the matter at all. On September 12th, 1990, the body of 56-year-old retired U.S. Air Force Major Charles Humphreys was found in Marion County, Florida. His head and torso had been pumped full of 6 bullets from a .22 caliber weapon. This time, the body was found fully clothed, and after searching further, his vehicle was found in Suwanee County. By all accounts, Charles Humphreys was a very noble man. He was well-respected in the community, and he had just celebrated his 35th wedding anniversary with his wife on September 11th. He had never made it home from his final day of work, and he had worked with the Florida Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services, where he specialized in protecting abused and injured children. A noble job, obviously. And I think if Eileen had known this about Charles Humphreys, you know, maybe she would have spared his life. Maybe she wouldn't have shot him. But again, like I say, we don't know what transpires in these cars. We don't know why Charles Humphreys picked up Eileen Warnos in the first place. But I think if Eileen would have known that he worked with abused kids and tried to protect them and he was one of the good guys, I think maybe she would have spared his life. You know, because she basically, since day one of her own life, she was abused as a young child. So I think maybe they could have found a common ground in this situation. Okay, so at this point in the story, let's just do a quick review. So we're now at 6 murders without a suspect whatsoever. During this time, Eileen and her lover Tyria were just continuing to live their lives as if nothing happened. They just continued living out as they normally would. And one thing that they loved to do would be to steal all the items from all these victims. And then they would sell them to whoever would buy them, or they would find pawn shops in whatever area they were in. And they would go to those pawn shops and they would sell some of the valuables that they had stolen. Actually, more likely what Eileen had stolen from the victims' vehicles. It was known that Eileen said that Tyria would also steal things on the side and sell them as well. So she said in an interview that was just something that they had to do to make ends meet. There was a point in time, I remember she said something like they needed $1,200 for rent and they needed it immediately. So they would go rob and steal, and that's how they would come up with their rent money. Now, I think Eileen must have thought she was invincible at this point, because here she is killing evil man after evil man in her mind. And then, you know, without any hint of any fuzz around the corner at all. So she must have been flying high, thinking she was going to be getting away with this. Possibly could. But this would change after the seventh body was found in Dixie County, Florida on November 19th, 1990. Walter Antonio, a 62-year-old trucker, security guard, and a police reservist, was found shot to death. His nearly naked body was found near an old remote logging road, and it appeared he had been shot four times, again with a .22 caliber weapon, for the seventh time that year. This time, though, the body had only been dead for 24 hours or less, somewhere around the 24-hour mark, so investigators started to get pretty excited. They're like, okay, we're here. It's been less than 24 hours. We know we're close, so we got to do something about this. They had to act fast in order to catch the suspect or suspects. In their minds, they thought it was two people that was doing all the killing. So Captain Steve Binegar of the Marion County Sheriff's Criminal Investigation Division led the search. He knew all about the various murders that had been happening in the past few months around the state of Florida, and he concluded they were all related. He got all the information, compiled it together, and created a theory and a thesis onto what could possibly be the suspect, where they could be, who it was, and he kept going back and remembering those two women that were seen walking away, you know, from Peter Seams' car that was crashed and, you know, found in the brush. He kept going back to those two figures. In late November, Reuters ran a story about those murders, and everyone was advised to be on the lookout for those two women that they had the sketch artist, you know, render up photos of those. So be on the lookout of those people is what they were telling everybody. By mid-December, authorities were fielding multiple leads and tips that just came flooding into the department. And most of these tips and all these leads that were coming in involved those same two women. People had been witnessing them around town or around that part of Florida. And they do remember one of them always with a .22 caliber handgun. Police had also found some of the victims belonging at the various pawn shops in the area. And also from some of the sites of the murders. Police ran the fingerprints that they had been finding, and they all matched the prints that from the same prints that had been found at some of the other crime scenes, more specifically the victims' cars that they had been finding. Upon further search of those, the prints came back, and they belonged to none other than Eileen Warnos. Her prints were in the national database because of all the different times she had been arrested. She was in the system already, so they found those prints at every location, and so they knew Eileen Warnos was the person they were looking for. On January 9th, 1991, Eileen was arrested on an outstanding warrant at The Last Resort, which was a biker bar in Volusia County. She was alone at the time, but they soon found her girlfriend up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the very next day. She was brought back to Florida, where police put her up in a hotel and treated her right, treated her like a queen to try to get her to open up and tell police what the hell was even going on. And they allowed her to make phone calls to Eileen from the hotel room to the jail where Eileen was being held. And the whole idea was to try to get Eileen to confess, open up, and, spill her guts to everybody. Tyria claimed she had nothing to do with the murders, and the only way her name would be cleared is if she could convince Eileen to, you know, take the fall for everything. After 3 days of phone calls being monitored between the two women, on January 16th, 1991, Eileen finally broke down and she admitted to all of the killings. She confessed and she said her girlfriend had nothing to do with any of it. She did it all on her own, no assistance. And the reason she claimed that she did it all was because the men were trying to rape her and she was only acting out of self-defense. Nonetheless, the monster was behind bars. A year later, on January 14th, 1992, the trial of Eileen Wuornos for the murder of Richard Mallory begin. Now, just as a refresher, if you remember, Richard Mallory was the first person that she had murdered, the one that she actually said raped her, went through with the full rape, and that's the reason that she had to kill him. All of her previous crimes that Eileen had committed throughout her life were brought to the forefront. All these crimes were used against her just to show her pattern of just terrible, reckless criminal behavior that she had been exhibiting pretty much her whole life. Tyra Moore also testified on the stand against her lover, and that was a star witness, and her testimony on the stand actually pretty much sealed the deal for the state of Florida. On January 27, 1992, Eileen Wuornos was found guilty of Richard Mallory's murder. The psychiatrist for the defense claimed that Eileen was not stable mentally, and most likely she suffered from borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. And then just 4 days later, after all this, Eileen was sentenced to death. By late March of 1992, Eileen had pled no contest to the other murders of Humphreys, Burris, and then David Spears. She told authorities that she was sticking to her story about the first murder of Richard Mallory, that he raped her, and that she was only acting out of self-defense. And then she admitted all those other ones, they didn't actually rape her, but they were trying to rape her, and they were trying to just beat her up. And so she basically preemptively acted out to save herself from being raped. That's why she was shooting all the guys. They weren't necessarily out of self-defense. She thought that it was her only way of escape would be to kill them, to get them out of the way, or else she was going to be brutally raped and possibly murdered later on. And then on May 15th, because of all this that she confessed and admitted to these other murders, she was given three more death sentences. By the time June had rolled around, Eileen Wuornos had racked up five death sentences. She wanted her initial murder of Mallory to be retried because she just continually pushed the issue of self-defense. She kept saying it was out of self-defense and she should not be charged with that murder. So she insisted she get a retrial on that. And then after they started looking into the past of Mallory, the defense wanted people to look at Richard Mallory's past, where he was committed to a maximum security prison in Maryland for attempted rape between 1958 and 1962. One doctor even claimed that he had, quote, strong sociopathic trends, end quote. We know, I mean, Richard Mallory definitely was not a model citizen, but the judge didn't even allow any of that information to be presented for the retrial, and so retrial was denied in the case of the murder of Richard Mallory. By February of 1993, Eileen was up to six death sentences that she had received. She did not receive a death sentence for Peter Seams' body. That was the one where they had stolen his car and crashed it off into the brush off the side of the highway. His body was never found, so she did not get a death sentence for that particular murder. Throughout the trial and various interviews, Eileen Wuornos had very conflicting stories when it came to why she committed these murders. At one point, she's claiming they all raped her, they were going to beat her to death, they deserved to die, she said. Other times, she claimed that Richard Mallory was the only one that raped her. And then sometimes she even claimed that that was a lie as well, that she just killed him in cold blood, you know? Once she knew her death sentence was imminent, she would tell anybody whatever they wanted to hear, as long as she would just be put to death no matter what. That was one thing that I really noticed, you know, watching and reading the interviews that she had done. You could tell she was just pushing for that death penalty. She wanted to die, plain and simple. And, you know, it was very interesting seeing these interviews of her talking, to see her mind shift back and forth. It was really strange to see. Something definitely was going on mentally with her. By the end, she was claiming that none of them raped her or even attempted to rape her. She said she was robbing the men because she needed the money and she needed to pay rent and all of her bills. And the reason she killed them was to eliminate any of the witnesses after the fact, you know, after she robbed everybody. She said, when asked if she planned any of the killings or if she, you know, as the vehicle slowed down to pick her up, if she already was planning in her mind to kill any of these people. One time she said no, but then on the other time, you know, she said she planned on killing all of them before she even hopped in their vehicles. She wanted it to be known, you know, as she's going into the death chamber here, that she did it all on her own, all free will, all just out of the love of murdering them. So it's really hard to just keep track of everything she was saying, because at one point you kind of almost start to feel a little bit sorry for her, because you know her past, and men just continually treated her like dog shit, trying to rape her, beat her. You start to feel sorry for somebody that does that, and you feel like maybe they did act out of self-defense. And then she starts changing her story. She says there was no self-defense, you know, and it was just all this murder was out of circumstance. And then all this circumstance caused her evil to come out. And by circumstance, what she meant was she knew what she was doing. She knew she was living a dangerous lifestyle. She was out there hitchhiking. She was out there hooking, trying to rob people. You know, and I think she was just lying now to try and beat the system. It was pretty easy to see that she wanted them to carry out her death sentence and just get it over with. And that's why she just kept changing her story so many times. She wanted everybody to see her as the crazy person that they were all calling her. She wanted to be as crazy as possible so there wouldn't be any chance that the death penalty would be taken off the table. She wanted that death sentence coming to her. She wanted to die. That's it. And her old lover, Tyra, also claimed that she was fearful of Eileen for most of the time they were together. Yes, they were in love. It was passionate. They had, you know, great times together. But she also stated that Eileen was very violent and pretty frightening at times. She was a possessive and a very jealous girlfriend. And Eileen always said that, you know, Tyra was the love of her life and she was going to love her until the day she died. But I don't think that this love was reciprocated. I think the first chance Tyra got, she threw Eileen right under the bus. And later on, you know, I know that affected Eileen in the way she thought, but later on, Eileen would claim that the reason her lover turned her in and the reason she cooperated with the police was for the movie rights and all the money that would come from all these movie rights. And even at one point, Eileen would say that the police were in on all this, that, you know, they knew money was coming. They knew they could, you know, make some movies out of this, write some books, and she claims they all were just using her. And as time progressed in prison, Eileen just became more and more paranoid. She was scared of everyone around her. And she, like I said, she said it was all the police's fault. They allowed her to just keep killing these men, in her opinion. She thought it was a conspiracy. And she thought she knew, or they knew that she was this murderer. They allowed a serial killer to be born. She thinks they could have stopped her after one murder, that they already knew who it was, but they were in it for the long haul and to try to make a dime off of all her actions. And I don't know. I mean, it sounds like a wild conspiracy theory. Sounds like somebody that really has mental issues going on upstairs. And she just thinks everybody wanted to get famous off of her. And she even pointed at Jeb Bush when he was governor of Florida. He was trying to move up the ladder, that political ladder, and she thinks he used those murders to do that as well. And while Eileen Wuornos was in prison, she also claimed she was constantly threatened by the guards with rape, torture, and all types of harassment. And she said while inside, she was always scared for her well-being. She knew for sure that they were trying to poison her food, in her mind anyway. She would never leave her jail cell to go take showers. She actually said she would shower in the sink to try to clean up a little bit because she was afraid to leave the safety of her cell. She said she was in there 24/7, barely ate the food that they gave her because she was scared that they were tainting it with something. She claimed she got sick, like violently sick, for about 3 days off of some food she noticed something strange on the top of it, sprinkled on it maybe, and she ended up being violently ill after that. And, you know, her paranoia just grew exponentially by the day until she was finally just fed up with it. And that's the one reason that she wanted the execution to commence, so she could just be done with all of it and just be on to heaven where she thought she was going. And in an interview, I have a quote here from Eileen Wuornos. She says, quote, "I killed those men, robbed them as cold as ice, and I'd do it again too. There's no chance in keeping me alive or anything because I'd kill again. I have hate crawling through my system. I am so sick of hearing this she's crazy stuff. I've been evaluated so many times. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and would kill again," end quote. Well, that says it all right there. I mean, whether she was telling the truth didn't really matter. She was sick of living, sick of having all these feelings towards people, specifically men, all the evil thoughts she felt towards men, and just the horrible way men treated her throughout her life. She was sick of it. And even after she confessed to all the murders, she was still harassed by men in prison. She could never escape men. In her final interview that I watched, she was as close to an insane person as there could be. She claimed her mind was manipulated and she was tortured with sonic pressure being applied to her head. She ranted about the food poisoning and abuse. She said the abuse would continually get worse if she ever complained about it. And she ended the interview basically by saying everyone used her to make money. They used her to make books and movies, television shows. And her final thing that I remember her yelling out was, quote, "A raped woman got executed and was used for books and movies and shit," end quote. So she went to her death, into that death chamber, just knowing everybody was using her for financial gain and for popularity to move up the political ladder. All these things were swirling through her mind. You know, I don't know what happens when you're on death row and you know that death is imminent. What thoughts go through your head? I'm sure you try to convince yourself of anything just to get through it all. Eileen Wuornos was executed on October 9th, 2002 at 9:47 a.m. She went to the gas chamber without eating her last meal. She refused it, but instead opted for just a plain cup of coffee. Her final words were just as crazy as you would imagine. Quote, "Yes, I would just like to say I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back, like Independence Day, with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie. Big mothership and all. I'll be back. I'll be back." End quote. Eileen's ashes were scattered under a tree in her hometown in Michigan. This concludes the Eileen Wuornos episode. I want to thank you again for listening to this two-parter. I know it might have been a tough one. It really was kind of a tough one for me because I really can't stand it when women get abused by men, especially the way that Eileen was treated by them. Just from an early age, she was being raped by her own grandfather and all his friends. She eventually became pregnant by one of these pigs and gave up this son of hers. You know, I don't condone murder, and I think her anger and her outrage was directed at the wrong people. Her mind was so warped by all the events that transpired in her life, she was just misguided. She eventually forgot the difference between right and wrong, and she just lashed out at the world, specifically lashed out at men. You know, and for me, what I take away from this is it goes to show how important it is to be there for your children as they grow up. Eileen's mother abandoned her at 6 months old. She left her with a sadistic monster, and even her own brother slept with her. And I watched a brief interview that they had with Eileen's biological mother, Diane, and she was as much as a piece of shit as I thought she would be. She really didn't have any remorse or really any care in the matter at all. She threw that baby away when she was 6 months old a long time ago, and she doesn't want to talk about it ever again, really. I mean, it just seemed like she was still looking for excuses. She wanted to be felt sorry for more than anything, it seemed like. And, you know, when Eileen was told this, that they had talked to her mother, and her mother was asking for forgiveness, and Eileen said she never wanted to see that whore of a woman ever. She never wanted to see her. She wasn't her mother. She didn't even know her. So keep that whore away. And that's what they did. And, you know, like I say, it is so important to be a good parent to your children. There was a prison interview that I saw with Eileen where she just lit up when they asked her, you know, if she would have been raised in a so-called normal household with a mom, a dad, and a normal brother, and they never beat her, they never raped her. They asked her if she just had a normal upbringing, what she thought her life would have turned out to be. And she just, like I said, she lit up and she said she would have thrived and had a great life. And she mentioned archaeology a couple times. Like she had ambitions at one point, it seemed like. And I think she probably would have had a great life had it not been for the terrible hand that life dealt her. So go hug your kids. Tell them that you love them. Support them in all their endeavors. Just be there for them, because it is more important than you know. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit the link in the notes for this episode and contribute in whatever way you can. If not, please continue to listen entirely for free, and just I ask you to share it with any people you know that might be interested in true crime, serial killers, that sort of thing. All I'm trying to do is get to the bottom of why people do what they do. My screenplay, Loon Lake, is also available for purchase and download on Amazon.com. If you're into thrillers and horror and slasher films, then this screenplay, it should be right up your alley. Especially if you've just enjoyed this podcast we've done on Eileen Wuornos. Loon Lake is, in a way, about the abuse that women endure, you know, due to all the evil men that are in their lives. So, you should check it out. Read it now before the film comes out later this year. Also, please visit 1129productions.com, and you can leave any questions or comments that you have in regards to the podcast or just anything in general. Let me know how I'm doing out here, would you? Again, I want to thank you for listening. I am your host, Abraham Archambeau. I hope you have sweet dreams.